You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, October 14th, 2008. My name is... 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times, the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, professor of history from Cornell University, Edward Baptiste, on the half that has never been told. Also on the program today, more protests in Ferguson, over a dozen arrested, including Professor Cornel West. Meanwhile, is Texas opting in to a Voting Rights Act pre-clearance? Opting in isn't necessarily how I would state that, but that's what we call it. Also, ISIS continues its march in Turkey. The Turks reportedly bomb Turkish Kurds or the PKK. It's not going to help. It's not going to help too much. Also on the program today, but for cuts, the NIH would have probably had an Ebola vaccine by now, on the heels of the report of the first U.S.-to-U.S. transmission of Ebola in that hospital which housed the first patient with Ebola in the United States. Sad news of Karen Lewis in Chicago. Brain tumor will prevent her from challenging Rahm Emanuel in the mayoral race. And we are only less than 3 weeks away now from the midterm elections. Races tightening up across the country. Mitch McConnell comes out with a bold stance of completely getting rid of Obamacare, except for in Kentucky. And meanwhile, Scott Brown potting it up. The UNH. Dude brought some brews. Trying to get some votes from the dudes. All that and more on today's program. Folks, I know a lot of you are anticipating our Halloween show, which is now just about 2 weeks away. And hopefully that will come off without a hitch. I have some, I don't know, is it sad news, mixed news? It turns out we're going to have to leave the Dollar Lunch District. Yes, I know. It's a little sad. Oh, but you can't hear how sad it is.
It's up.
We're going to have to leave the Dollar Lunch District. Apparently, the way you do business in real estate is if you're going to raise the rent on somebody's office, you give them the lease as late as you can, and then you spring it on them that you're raising the rent. We have been talking about wanting to get bigger space and to go to, well, bigger space for, I don't know, 4 years that the show has been in existence. We're in, you know, I mean, it would be a big walk-in closet. Let's put it that way. And I wouldn't mind moving the show to Brooklyn. So we're going to have to do that, and we're going to have to do it very quickly. So in addition to we're going to have to launch some type of fundraiser, I think, next week. We may have some days off over the next 2 weeks as we move. I don't know, a mover is in the offing. So Matt and Michael, start doing your push-ups. And we got to find a van, the whole thing. So I just wanted to let you know that these are our final days over the next couple of weeks in the Dollar Lunch District. We are actively seeking new places to get a slice of pizza for a dollar in Brooklyn, probably in downtown Brooklyn. I've got some leads on some good pizza places there. So we got to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Edward Baptiste, whose book on slavery is entitled The Half That Has Never Been Told. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone, professor of history from Cornell University, Edward Baptiste, on his book, The Half That Has Never Been Told. Welcome to the program, professor.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So let's start. We have to start with this just because The Economist wanted us to. I'm speaking of The Economist magazine. And you received I think it was an uncredited review at The Economist. But I guess they don't do the bylines. Criticizing your book on slavery, saying that you were unfair to the slave owners, which I assume was one of the assumptions of slavery that you set out to debunk in your book. Just tell us your response to that review.
Well, the review said a couple of really interesting things. One of them was it complained that in the book, according to the reviewer, all of the slaves were victims and all of the slave owners were villains. And people on social media reacted, in particular to the second point that they made. And they said, well, you know, by definition, on some level, all slave owners were villains because they participated in a system that we now judge as villainous. So I think the book, on one level, sort of digs into the different layers of that, the ways in which slavery was connected to larger systems, the ways in which it exploited people, and the ways in which it was a profoundly violent system, even when enslavers might have thought of themselves as not being the perpetrators of that, or the direct perpetrators of that violence. They actually were the perpetrators of that violence.
Over time, it seems that the perceptions around that dynamic, that in many respects slave owners were benevolent and brought new opportunity to the slaves. I mean, it seems sort of ridiculous to say it now, but that perception had a lot of durability, didn't it?
Yeah, it has had a lot of durability. And I think if you think about the ways that we talk about violence against enslaved people, or the ways at times that we don't talk about it or talk about it as something other than violence, you'll see exactly how durable it's been. Because we have a special category in the way that we think about violence for the whippings that are done that were done to enslave people. I mean, for a long time, historians talked about this as a kind of discipline, right? As if it was a way that you would train your pet or a way that you would discipline your child. And then at times when historians pointed out that sometimes these whippings were quite violent, they also often backtracked and suggested that they were not a inherent part of the system. But what my research shows and what other historians have been showing as well is that in fact it was systematic, that whipping was directly calibrated to production on these slave labor camps to make cotton, and that cotton was the most important product in the world in the early 1800s. So it was really violence that was incessant and that was very well organized that drove the expansion of the Western economy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the point that I think, or the points around that are so incredibly illuminating. The idea that so much of this was systematized, and I mean, one could almost draw a line between the amount of whipping and sort of a bond rate in some way, right? I mean, maybe that's carrying it just a little bit too far, but walk us through that. I mean, I'm particularly fascinated about this element of the system in light of an interview I did a couple of weeks ago with Chris Hayes, who has written about comparing the involvement of capital and the extraction of value from slaves with the involvement of capital and the extraction of value when it comes to fossil fuels. Obviously, from a moral sense, there's no comparison. But on that level, it is interesting to view it in that light.
Yeah, I think there are multiple kinds of if you will, free labor or free capital or stolen capital. I think they're probably stolen capital is the best way to think about it, that go into the construction of the worldwide global economy, which is supposedly based solely on the free interchange of wage labor and capital, and really complicate our understanding of it. But very specifically, in this case, it worked like this. So an enslaved person who would be, let's say, sold from Virginia to Mississippi would be brought onto the plantation, or as I call them, slave labor camps. And the first day they were supposed to pick cotton. And picking cotton was this crucial bottleneck in the production process, right, that really wasn't solved by machine until the 1950s. But they were told to pick cotton, and this would establish their sort of basic rate. And then the job of the enslaver and his overseer, as they saw it, would be to push that basic rate up. So if the enslaved person fell short of their quota on the second day, they would be whipped. And often it was very calibrated. They would be whipped the same number of lashes as they were pound short. Once they could regularly meet that quota, the quota would then rise. They would be required to pick more. And everybody had an individual quota that was tailored to what they had done in the past and what the slave owner thought they could do in the future or the next day. And over time, what you find is that the average picking rate rises 2% per year from 1800 to 1860, so that it's four times faster. People are picking cotton four times faster in 1860 than they are in 1800. And this makes a massive difference. It, even as the demand for cotton is rising, as the worldwide factory system grows and people are buying these clothes left and right, and clothes are getting much cheaper all the time, even as that's happening, the actual price of cotton, the real price, the inflation-adjusted price of cotton is dropping to 25% of what it had been in 1800. And this is the primary reason why.
And so to what extent did slave owners, I mean, how scientific were they in making that determination of what would increase productivity? In other words, were there actual sort of experiments, A-B tests as to what would create more, would get more productivity out of their slaves?
Yeah, we don't, to my knowledge, we don't know of any sort of organized experiments that happen. You know, there's some sort of haphazard tests, or there's haphazard discussion about what seeds are best, what plowing methods are best, and so on. But I think they don't really need to experiment when it comes to driving people to pick faster, because they've found a system that works, and the evidence of that is all around them. It's there in the records they keep, and in the records of increased production. But if you want to think about it for a minute, you can see that actually if there is an experiment, right? If there is a process of sort of time and movement study that's going on, that study is actually being carried out by enslaved people on themselves. You know, the experimentation, the scientific management is being outsourced to them by the enslaver by force. They have to figure out how to do it. They have to figure out how to move faster all the time. And so it's their creativity, their experimentation, that's responsible for this massive rise in production. But of course, it's extracted at a horrific cost, and it's not free. It's not free labor in that sense.
You use the metaphor of a body to describe slavery, and I think you suggest you take that from the author Ralph Ellison, who described U.S. history as a vast drama being played out on a Negro giant. Talk about why you use that metaphor and how.
Well, at a certain level, it's something that. That I more or less intuited after reading Ellison and struggling with his problem of how to organize the book. And then I tried it, and I saw that it worked in certain ways. But the problem of organizing the book was that you can write a history book chronologically, where you say this happened, and then this happened, and then that happened, and A caused B to happen, which caused C to happen. Or you can write it topically, where you say, okay, here I'll talk about labor, here I'll talk about family, here I'll talk about politics. And putting those two together, right, so that you have a book that moves both chronologically and topically, is a challenge. But I think it's the best way to organize a book, especially if you're talking about a big phenomenon that you're trying to connect to the whole of U.S. history. And I found that talking about that using the body as a metaphor actually worked, because I could demonstrate the ways in which enslavers tried to build up power and tried to build up control, often by literally isolating the parts of enslaved people's bodies and making them work against enslaved people's own interests, making their feet move them, move enslaved people from Virginia to Mississippi while their hands were chained together, making their hands pick faster, even though picking faster actually only meant you would have to pick faster still the next day. So it connected to a lot of different issues in the book. But, you know, at a certain level, it's one of those things that you just come to intuitively, and either it works or it doesn't. So I guess the readers will let me know about that.
Let's talk about that dynamic of sort of the internal, I guess, forced migration of slaves. What brought that about, and how did that play out?
What brought it about was that in the 1780s, there's a very large enslaved population in Virginia and North Carolina and Maryland. But the products that they make most successfully there, tobacco and grain, were not bringing enough money on the world market to pay the debts that those enslavers, like Thomas Jefferson, for instance, owed. And some enslavers reacted to that and to, the ideas of the American Revolution, and in some cases to religious conversion by actually freeing enslaved people. But others saw that there was a growing market in South Carolina and Georgia where cotton was just coming into cultivation. There was a growing market there, and so they helped to create this domestic internal slave trade, which is going to expand and continue as a process of moving enslaved laborers from one place to another, all the way up until 1865, in fact, as right before Richmond falls, there's still slaves being sold in Richmond itself. And this is a really interesting, organized process in which market systems grow and change dramatically over time. They're repeatedly innovated, but they really get better and better at connecting one set of sellers to another set of buyers. And in that sense, it's a classic capitalist story.
And this, it was in the first decade of the 1800s, I believe, is when we stopped, when we made it illegal, is that right, to import slaves? And so,
that's right.
And so that sort of like internal trade became that much more relevant. It really is. You step back and you see it's an efficiency issue, right, for these people, for the slave owners on some level.
Right. Yeah, I mean, in a sense, the U.S. had developed this large enslaved population in the Upper South, and so one way to look at it is to say that they didn't need the Middle Passage anymore in order to expand slavery in the United States and move enslaved people to where they could produce the most profit for their owners. But I think the consequences of it are really significant. I mean, one consequence is that it builds this speculation in African American bodies right into the fabric of American society, into white society, and it also repeatedly exposes people to just horrible things that are being done to enslaved people's bodies right in front of them. And the same thing happens with the whipping on the plantation. And so they come up with all sorts of ways to justify this and articulate it. And I think when we see experiments today in which we find that observers don't see the level of pain that African Americans are experiencing in a particular medical procedure as being equivalent to the level of pain that whites are experiencing in the same medical procedure, I think we start to see some of the long-term consequences of this, deeply embedded process of cruelty in everyday life.
Expand on that as to the legacy of that.
Well, I think that in the process of slavery, white people in general in the United States got used to thinking of African American people's bodies as resources to be exploited, or, you know, even if you're an abolitionist, they were resources to be debated about, to be calculated on in a different way. And I don't mean to say there's a moral equivalence between abolitionists and enslavers, because there really wasn't. But even there, it was hard for them to get out of that trap of talking about African Americans as if they were not fully equivalent to whites. And so in particular, I think the violence that's done to enslaved people repeatedly continues to play out. And African Americans are seen throughout U.S. history as a population that needs to be controlled. Even white abolitionists are very frightened of the possibility of slave revolt, see it in some ways as a greater evil than slavery itself. And this continues. I'm convinced it plays out in the ways that policing is done in the United States, and I'm convinced it's playing out today in the events that we see dramatized in Ferguson and St. Louis.
How do you think that happens? I mean, and maybe this is outside of your portfolio, as it were. But I mean, how does? I would imagine in the context of history, you see these sort of ideas and these notions and these perspectives of that one group of people has on another, and even I would imagine on some level that is internalized by those groups that are sort of, particularly those that are sort of subjugated to a broader society. How are those communicated through the years?
Well, I think there are a lot of ways it's communicated. I think what I can probably talk the most usefully, what I can probably speak the most usefully to would be our perceptions of history. And let's go back to talking about how people have talked about whipping over the years. So in any other context, we would call the things that were done on a routine basis in order to produce more cotton, we would call those things that were done to African Americans' bodies torture. We would certainly call it torture if an American pilot was shot down and captured by ISIL or something like that, because these were truly brutal whippings that cut people's skin open. And you know, to refine the cruelty even more, enslavers did other things, that there's simply an endless list of the kinds of things that that they did, which the UN would certainly define as torture. But we don't call it torture, right? We don't call it torture in our history. We might call it labor discipline. We might even call it whipping. But that doesn't get, and it doesn't begin to get to the actual violence that was done, and that people simply accommodated into their daily lives as whites, the presence of these things in their own societies. They found a way to deal with it, even as they were outlawing those kinds of punishments when it came to whites. So in the early 19th century, at the very beginning, you could still have your ear cut off or have your hand branded or something like that if you were a white thief. But instead, other kinds of punishments are invented specifically because they don't do to white bodies what is being done on a routine basis to black bodies. It marks the difference between them, treats them as bodies, treats white bodies as bodies with more dignity, and black bodies as bodies which can be tortured, which pain can and should be inflicted upon.
We don't even seem to have a term or a concept for that, do we? I mean, when you say whipping, one's mind necessarily goes to an individual act, but this was this was so programmatic, this torture, that we don't even have in our lexicon a way to describe it in some way, in the same way that we would, let's say, genocide. If we were to kill people in this manner, we don't. And slavery itself does not seem to be up, that term does not seem to be up to the task.
Yeah, I think that's a really perceptive point. It comes to us in stories that are told by individuals who experienced it, or they watch close relatives experience it. And these are stories of tremendous individual trauma, and that's really important to think about and to talk about. But as you point out, it's the systematization of the whole, of that whole apparatus of torture, which in some ways has an even greater effect. And, you know, this is a crucial tool of developing and maintaining white supremacy in the United States. And it's bound to leave a long-term legacy, a legacy that is, greater than the individual life, the individual lifespan. It's longer than the individual lifespan of one particular survivor or another particular survivor. So I think you're very right to point to the system. That side of it is crucial to understand. And I don't know what the word would be, though.
Yeah, I don't either. And it's never really occurred to me that we don't have a term for that. When we would, if we were to have engaged in the sort of the mass killing of millions, opposed to the sort of the systemic torture as a mechanism to increase productivity. And it's not just about productivity for the slave owners. I mean, in many respects, there is no broader American economy for those 150 years, I guess, without without slavery. I mean, this has impacts across the country. I mean, talk about the dynamic of clothes that clothes from the Northeast are manufactured and in some ways, I guess, protected through a tariff system to clothe slaves.
Yeah, that's a key part of this story of U.S. industrialization. There's a historian at Brown named Seth Rockman who's writing a book on that now, which is going to be fantastic. Basically, what he's found so far, if I understand correctly, and part of this is a story we've known, but he's really expanding on it, is that, as you're suggesting, there's a protected market that's created in the United States. Most of the cotton that the U.S. Produces is made by enslaved people, and most of it goes to Great Britain. Great Britain is ahead of the U.S. in the sort of industrial race, and they make finer quality cloths more easily than the sort of infant U.S. factories in Massachusetts and Rhode Island are making by the 18-teens. So what Congress does is it imposes a tariff that keeps out the cheaper cloth, but opens the door to the wealthier cloth that the middle class and the upper class is going to want to buy. And so now the factories in New England can enjoy a protected market for the cloth that they make. And in particular, where they sell to is the South. because enslaved people who may have spun and wove their own cloth in the 1700s are now so heavily tasked picking cotton that they don't have time to do that. So enslavers buy clothes made from cotton that they themselves had picked and give the cloth to enslaved people to sew up into clothes, actually. So they're participating in that sense in creating a consumer market for for the product of the product that they make.
Tell us just a little bit about Charles Ball. I want people to get a sense of just how many sort of personal stories, and I believe there was something like you had over 2,000 sort of journal entries or direct correspondence from that time that made up at least part of your research. Tell us a little bit about Charles Ball.
So what we have in terms of words that come from formerly enslaved people, primarily we've got about 100 19th century autobiographies and memoirs that were published by people after they got out of slavery, whether like Charles Ball, they escaped during slavery itself or after it was over. And then we've got about 2,200 interviews that were done with survivors, elderly survivors of slavery during the 1930s. And this is an extremely rich and complicated resource. But Charles Ball's story is one of the earliest to be published in the United States. It's first published in 1837, I think. And he was born in the 1780s in Maryland. And things seem to be going as well for him as they can be going in 1805. He's got a wife and kids, and he thinks he might be able to earn enough money from side jobs on Sundays to actually buy his freedom one day. And then he finds out that he's been sold. He finds out that he's been sold by literally being kidnapped, as he experiences it. He's grabbed by a large group of white men and put in handcuffs. By the man who now owns him, the slave trader, who then chains into about 30 other men and marches him all the way from Maryland down to South Carolina. And that's where he learns what life is like on these new slave labor camps on the cotton frontier. He has to learn how to pick. He has to sort of rebuild his life and separation and isolation from his family. But one of the unique things about him is that he actually escapes. And about 1808 or 1809, he leaves in the middle of the night and takes off and begins this odyssey of about 3 months in winter most of the time that eventually takes him back to his wife's cabin in Maryland. And he finds out that she has not remarried. And he's able to live with her for another couple of decades.
And we should say that story of separation from family is not ancillary to the process, but it is. I mean, that's not a bug, but that is a feature, right? I mean, you want
Absolutely.
To separate them. I mean, all these things that we, when we look back on slavery, that we see as sort of side effects, are in fact more built into the system because there is such a because of the implications of productivity.
Yeah, I mean, all slave societies, some scholars argue, have these features of what's called social death, of ripping people out of the networks that give their lives meaning, you know, kinship, religion, social practices, all these sorts of things, and forcing them to take on new names, new lifestyles, et cetera. And in the United States, by the late 1700s, most people, some people are still being brought from Africa, and they're experiencing that process of social death, if you will, really violently. But many people were born in these sort of rich kinship networks, and those networks and those communities gave them the opportunity and the tools to soften some of the edges of slavery in all kinds of ways, to make it harder for enslavers to exploit them quite as successfully, for women to help protect them in some cases from sexual violence, all sorts of processes that give them allies and give them tools that they need. And so taking people out of that environment and bringing them to a new environment where they don't know any of the people who they're with, right? And they're also experiencing this really massive life shock of separation from family is part of what it allows enslavers to impose all of these new conditions of work in this super speeded up exploitation that we see. But, you know, I don't want to say that's the same thing that happens to immigrants and it's the same thing that happens to wage workers as industries change, because it is different. But at the same time, we can see echoes of the constant process of change that we all experience in modernity and modernization. And that sometimes those changes are changes we seek out, but sometimes they're changes that are imposed on us for the benefit of other people. And the shock itself is one of the tools that's used to force us to accept the new conditions, when perhaps we might, given that we're not enslaved, we might be able to resist them if we work together more effectively.
Interesting. And lastly, tell us about Franklin Armfield, because I think that firm sort of is indicative of the other half of this equation in terms of how much of how sophisticated I guess an element of slavery was in our economy.
Yeah, that becomes the biggest firm in the slave trading business by about 1830. Isaac Franklin, John Armfield, and Rice Ballard, and it has offices in Baltimore and Richmond and New Orleans and Natchez. And it's by the early 1830s, it's moving several thousand people a year from the southeast to the southwest. It's very sophisticated in its financial operations, very sophisticated in its advertising techniques. And if we were to really get a handle, and there are some historians who are working on this question now, like Josh Rothman at the University of Alabama, if we were to get a real handle on how much money they were moving, and I've done some ballpark calculations on this based on my own research, we would probably find that after the big banks in the United States, this might have been the single largest firm operating in the United States in the early 1830s. And that shouldn't be a surprise, because most enslaved men, for instance, young men who were sold in New Orleans, went in the early 1830s for a sale price of anywhere between maybe $700 and $1,000. And if we work that out in today's money, the different ways to calculate it, but economists who look at this sort of thing will tell you that that's equivalent to somewhere between $50,000 and $250,000 today. So these folks, for the 1830s economy, were dealing with huge, huge sums of money, huge, huge amounts of value. And the value, of course, was based ultimately on human bodies.
And the thing that I think people have to understand, too, is that even in this context, they required capital, right? I mean, so this is intimately tied into the banking system.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a great point. You know, they were some of the sort of favorite children of the banks in all the towns where they were based, because in Natchez and New Orleans, where they dealt with the Bank of the United States, which was chartered by Congress, it was sort of the Federal Reserve of its day, or in the East, where they dealt with the biggest banks in Richmond and Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. And in those places, these guys were great, because they moved so much cash. They required credit, but they paid it back, and they paid it back with interest, and they paid it back on time. You know, this is the one product that was always commanding a good price, if you will.
I mean, that part about it is really fascinating. Do you have a sense of just how much the banking industry profited and relied on the slavery industry, for lack of a better term, in terms of, because when you have that type of money running through your banks and you have loans that you know are as close to sure bets as you can get, and massive loans, it seems to me, that generates all sorts of other economic development that ostensibly has nothing to do with slavery.
Absolutely. I mean, that's very true. And the fact that, you know, the fact that it's even controversial to talk about this now is I think very telling of the way that we've tried to avoid coming to terms with some very basic facts. Here's one very basic fact. Cotton accounted for 50% of the value of all U.S. exports in almost every year before 1860. So it's absolutely crucial to the U.S. economy. Of course, it's made by slaves. Enslaved people were 20% of all of the wealth in the United States during just about every decade before 1860. So, and not only are they 20%, they're also the most liquid 20% for the reasons you just suggested. You know, they're great collateral because you can always sell a human being and find a market in antebellum America. So, the banks absolutely rely on slaves as you know, one of the crucial counterweights in the economy, one of the crucial kinds of capital that enables them to make other kinds of loans. But also, of course, the product that they make, cotton, allows the constant flow of credit, commercial credit, coming in from Great Britain, which then has all kinds of other effects that lead to economic growth.
And it's this sort of, I guess, interwoven dependence on this institution of slavery, which obviously made it something that, you know, aside from the moral issues, but why it was so wrenching to get rid of that institution.
Yeah, it's very hard to convince people to give up 20% of national wealth, especially the people for whom that's 100% in effect of their particular wealth, and often those people were extremely political powerful, and you know that's why we have a long conflict over the expansion of slavery, and that long conflict over the expansion of slavery is why the United States ends up in a civil war.
Professor Edward Baptist, the book is The Half Has Never Been Told. We will link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks for talking to me. Enjoyed it.
All right, folks. We will take a brief break in a moment and then head into the funner half. And just a reminder, if you joined us late, our days in the Dollar Lunch District, in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times are numbered. Our rent has gone up in a way which I found very annoying, but I'm not going to malign anybody until I get my deposit back, my security deposit back.
That's right. That's an important principle of New York real estate.
Exactly. Let's all just be friends until that check clears.
Yep.
So we need your support more than ever as we make this not totally unwelcome, but somewhat unplanned move across the East River. And it's going to involve moving stuff. When I first got here, I could fit mostly everything we had in my Subaru. Subaru's got like 180,000 miles on that baby. I don't know if we're going to... Now we're going to need like a minivan. So become a member today at majority.fm. Or if you don't like the idea of subscribing and becoming a member, you can always hit our donate button at majority.fm. We're going to try and get our stuff together and do a fundraiser starting in the next week or two, like an Indiegogo type of thing, I guess, is what the kids call it. And
also what the website.
What websites call it.
Right.
Kids call it Indiegogo.
Kids.
All right. So good for the kids. They got it right. They got it right. The kids got it right. You can also support this program if you buy crap from Amazon. Not a particularly great company, folks. But if you buy crap from Amazon, in fact, we've got a story about how the U.S. government, in a court case dealing with a contractor of Amazon's, when they search people as they're leaving the warehouses, making sure they haven't stolen anything, can take up to 25 minutes, maybe a half hour. And workers don't get paid for that. So if you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is siphon some off to somebody who's going to tell you how bad Amazon is. Mm. And you can do that by going to majorityreportkickback.com, clicking on the Amazon link. So if you buy anything from there, always buy it through that link, and you can support people who are criticizing Amazon for their labor practices. I'm not sure if I buy the monopoly argument. I'm not sure about that. I got to dig into that more, but the labor problems, I think, are well-founded. Also, JustCoffee.coop. Now, there's a company you can buy coffee from and feel great about it with no misgivings whatsoever. Fair trade coffee, delicious coffee. Everybody involved in the process of delivering that coffee to you gets a fair wage. It is employee owned. Thus, it's .coop as opposed to a .com. And you get 10% off by using the coupon code MAJORITY. Plus, there's a Majority Report blend, which makes an amazing Halloween gift. You can give that out to kids when they come to your door in the bags for their parents, maybe. I don't know. Maybe it's not appropriate for the kids.
Wasn't that, wasn't there like an old Saturday Night Live, like it was a Coneheads thing, right? And they handed out beer and eggs?
Yeah, like possible. Beer.
Yeah, okay.
Well, this coffee. And also, but it's also a great Thanksgiving gift. Oh, it was showing up at your house. It's Thanksgiving.
There you go.
Here's a bag of coffee. Was going to bring wine, but I know you got plenty of that. Here's some great Majority Report coffee. Then your crazy uncle at Thanksgiving is like, well, I don't appreciate this, but I really like the coffee. So they're stuck now buying Majority Report coffee, even though that they're, you know, going to Sarah Palin rallies. So it's justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Buy the Majority Report blend. What else? Give us go to donateyouraccount.com. Donate your Twitter or your Facebook posts. We don't spam it. We only do high-quality stuff. And it's not just promotion of this or that. It's actual quality content that people are going to be happy that you're sharing with them. Give us a review on iTunes. There's a lot of way of supporting the program. Do you have a van? Donate your van to us for a ride over to Brooklyn. That may be a little bit trickier. I don't know. I want to get involved with the liability of that. All right, we're going to take a break. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me through the newly updated app at majorityapp.com. Or you can call us and be part of the program. We'll be back in just a moment. And stand by, folks, because we do have some Scotty B news to report. And we're not going to have many more time to do that until he...
because, like, I'm going to lose to Gene Shaheen? Dude, whatever.
If the dude loses to Gene Shaheen, guess who's up next? I just run in Maine, dude. I go to Vermont.
Go to New Hampshire again.
All right, we'll be right back after this.
Vermont is... That's like the one place...
They got good skiing in Vermont. Why? What's the problem with that?